There's a Sufi anecdote from the master. His name's Shibli. Cute name. And Shibli talks about that he came upon another Sufi master named Nuri, my light, and found Nuri sitting so still in meditation that he had to ask him, he says, how did you learn to be so, to create such meditative absorption? And Nuri responded, who taught you such meditative absorption? He says, I learned it from a cat. I watched a cat sitting in a mouse hole. And so it's like the question is, do we have the commitment of a cat?
Yeah.
A cat has a single-pointed focus. Single-pointed focus. Dedication to a purpose. And can we maintain even a quarter of that, that kind of concentration? But I want to broaden the context of the use of meditation, because we've gotten into a very narrow definition of meditation in our culture. Recently, it's very recent. Meditation comes from meditatio in Latin. And meditatio basically means, meditatio basically means to measure out thought. To measure out thought. And, it's has an Indo-European root, meh, means to measure. And it shows up through a number of words like the Latin for doctor, medicus. A doctor, someone who takes the measure of something, gives a diagnosis, who measures out medication. But to measure out thought basically means to think deeply about something, to give your thought deeply to something. So in that sense, meditation pretty much means the same as what we mean today by contemplation, to contemplate something. And there's a kind of curious flipping of terms that's happened over time, because in Catholic contemplative thought through the Catholic mystical traditions, they've been using meditatio and contemplatio for a very long time. But they use them in exactly the opposite way that we use them today. So we talk about discursive meditations, long meditations, thinking through something, and we call that contemplation today. They call that meditatio, a discursive meditation. And then meditative absorption, one-pointed meditative absorption or stilling the mind, they call that contemplatio. So it's an interesting juxtaposition and changing around of terms. But I bring it up basically to say both of these are interchangeable, and meditation, the way we've been using it, especially since Zen Buddhism was really introduced in the 30s and 40s in the United States and really came to change the way we oriented toward that word, thinking of it as stilling the mind, meditative absorption, that's fairly recent. Meditation had a much broader sort of association to it. And I think it's important to keep that kind of broad way of looking at it, because a number of practices come within that umbrella category that is meditation. In Sufism, there are roughly five sorts of practices that come underneath that meditation category. Dhikr, of course, which some of you were in here, we talked about dhikr, the remembrance practice, the mantric type practice where we repeat one of the divine names or a sacred phrase over and over and over, creating that flywheel in consciousness until the discursive mind starts to break down and releases into a single-pointed focus or an absorption. So there's thicker. Then there's thicker, F-I-Q-R, F-I-K-R. And fikr is actually the word in Arabic for contemplation. And in the Sufi tradition, it's used two ways. One, fikr for contemplation, contemplating an idea or notion or a maqam, a particular quality, and spending time contemplating beauty or tawbah, repentance, whatever it might be. In the Anayati lineages, we've tended to use fikr as a practice of putting the wazifa, the mantra, on the breath. For instance, doing toward the one as an exhalation, and then toward the one as an inhalation. Or pairing two wazif, ya kadus, ya kahar, but internally, silently. So that's been fikr practice for us within this lineage. Then there's muhasaba, which is an interesting word because it means something like precise accounting, you know, taking an account of something. It's interesting, in Arabic there are lots of words for accounting, you know, because, you know, the language of Mecca was a language of commerce. These were people that took their caravans out. They knew accounting. They didn't have a written language at the time, you know, not a written language, but they had a lot of words for keeping accounts. And muhasaba is kind of, you might think of it as kind of a soul accounting. Taking yourself to task in some ways for the way you're living your life, looking back on it in a certain way. For instance, at the end of the day, when you're in your bed at night, you might walk backwards in your mind through your day. You know, what was I just doing? I just brushed my teeth. And as I was brushing my teeth, I had these thoughts. And then I had this interaction with my wife. And we talked about this, and there was a little tension there. And then just go backward through your day. Re-explore it backward and note these moments that you might have done better, or you didn't quite like the way you reacted, or were reactive to somebody. And follow it back to the beginning. That would be an example of doing muhasaba, doing this kind of accounting practice. Or just taking a topic, you know, one particular theme, anger, and just explore your relationship to anger, and especially around very particular instances that you can think of, you know, where you've been affected by someone else's, or you've been expressing it, and how did those go? The same sorts of thing. So that's a very specific practice of meditative practice within Sufism. A fourth one is dua, prayer. And I think it's unfortunate that people divorce prayer from their ideas of meditation. And often think of it as something lesser, you know, especially, you know, under a lot of more recent Buddhist influence, there's meditation, and then there's Christians who pray and Muslims who pray, and there's a little bit of a downgrading of it, especially because of God language. But prayer is a very powerful meditative practice, and I would say, in some sense, essential for us as human beings, because we're expressive beings. No matter what your God idea is, we still have a need to express out. As Reb Zalman, my teacher, would have put it, he says, it's very hard to talk to the Omni, Omni, Omni God, you know? The God that's all and everything, and, you know, where do I look, you know? You know, the God that is me. We're relational beings. And prayer is one of our means of being relational in our expressing our deepest feelings toward God. You know, we were talking about this the other day, or I was talking about with some of the people that were in here about Rabia al-Adawiyah's saying that, you know, I've loved God with two loves, one that is unworthy and one that is worthy, and the unworthy love, I think only of you. And in the worthy love, there's only you. Well, that's a momentary experience where, you can experience a sense of unity with the divine being, lack of separation. But there's so much power and longing when you express the beloved and feel the beloved as opposite you, and that there's a gap to overcome. And I was talking about how Al-Ghazali was saying, that's almost higher. Because the longing is so great, you're so much feeling and emotion is coming up that wants to embrace. And that leads to a union where you lose all of that, but then we don't stay in that unified state. We return to this state again. Prayer is what gets expressed in that longing. I once had a student come up to me and he said, what does God need our, what does an all-knowing God need our prayers for? Why do we even have to say them? I said, because we need to say them. Now, it's not that God needs them. We need to express. You know, how would it be in your relationship with your partner if you just never said, I love you? She knows. He knows. You know? See how that works. It's necessary to say it. And again, referring to my teacher, he would say, how would it be in your relationship if you actually express I love you, and your partner says, you told me that yesterday. You see, it's not information.
Yes.
It's not mere information. It's a welling up in the heart that needs to be expressed. If it was just information, I'd put it in a note, leave it here, you can always look at it. It's not information. Except in the sense that, this is welling up, and it's coming out of me. So prayer is this. Yes?
Can I add something?
Please.
That need to express was put into us by God.
Yes.
Because he wants us to have that relationship.
Drawing us forward. And all these various practices, again, sometimes today are categorized in a way where they say, well, those are not as profound as the meditative absorption that comes through a stilling the mind practice. It's not true either. Any one of these practices can lead to meditative absorption that stilled the mind and have been known to throughout the history of spiritual practices. Prayer that goes so deep that it breaks through into complete absorption. I mean, that's been a recorded phenomenon since anybody has been writing about prayer. Even the soul accounting process, going back, and then you hit something that you just stay with, you stay with, you stay with, and then everything dissolves. They all can lead to that. So there is no need to privilege particular spiritual practices. In fact, we need to get into a relationship of feeling into different ones so that we can find the one that best suits our being. I don't think everybody needs to be a tranquility type meditator. It may be for you, prayer is your best mode. But it's good to know all the tools in the toolkit in case prayer is not working for you one day. You know, you may not be a vicar person, but you should know how to do it, you know. You may not generally be a prayer person. There'll come a moment when you need it. I don't know a single human life where somebody hasn't come to a moment where they haven't needed prayer. Prayer is what you do when you have nothing left. And you'll find yourself calling on someone that, you know, you didn't even know somebody was there, but you want them to be there at this point when you're completely powerless. You got no tools left, nobody else to call. You'll start to pray. And now that I've built all those others up, now I'm going to talk about the meditation that is cultivating inner stillness, inner quietude.
Quick yes. question.
Tasni and then.
Were those the five that you were enumerating?
Yeah. So Murakaba would be the fifth that we're about to talk about.
But meditation in action, like whirling or meditation state, reaching meditative state through absorption in something like music. Put those two.
That could be another category. Listening, sema, listening. And I was explaining to somebody the other day, and they were saying they were watching. It's your son-in-law, right? Whirling. What is his name? Is it Aziz or Aziz?
What is it called?
Aziz, who turned the other night.
Yeah. So Aziz was doing the turning, and somebody said to me the next day, "I said, watch that. I could never do that. I'd get so dizzy." I said, no, it's a training. If you're not meditating, you will fall down. Because it is a meditation, and if you're not meditating, you just crash very quickly. You have to learn a particular focus, so that is a meditation technique. Or it goes very badly, very quickly.
But it's not just the turner, it's all of us that are meditating on that. People think it's just that person that's having the spiritual experience. Mm-hmm. But when you see really good turning, it's transforming.
Mm-hmm. It takes you.
Yeah.
You know, the turner can become the object of your meditation.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Watching the turn. So a meditative object is a lot of what a tranquility meditation practice is about. Getting into a relationship with an object of meditation, whether that be the breath, a heartbeat, a flame, you know. Many different objects or word. So I wanted to broaden the context of meditation before going into this. Also with prayer and we don't talk about this much anymore, but in traditional Sufi orders there's usually something called a wird. Anybody heard of a wird?
Yeah.
Yes. You know what it is?
Bird.
Yeah, same thing.
Litany.
Yeah, litany. So, you know, in addition to doing salah, you know, which is prayer in Islam, and in Islam you make this distinction between salah and dua, because salah is not just prayer generally, it's a specific prayer form. Prayer five times a day with the prostrations in a specific order, done in a particular way. But in most traditional Sufi orders, there's often been a verd or wird, which is a particular litany of extra prayers that belong to the lineage that are done around your salah. Nawafil, supererogatory prayers, you know, extra things that you would do. And so if you were a Mevlevi, there would be Rumi's rose prayer that would be in there, or the light prayer. And they have a number of nice things in there, the prayer of Isa and the prayer of Ibrahim, all built in there. We have something in the Sufi tradition that are something like sutras. Do you know what a sutra is?
Mm-hmm.
For those of you who don't, a sutra within Hindu and Buddhist traditions, this word sutra in Sanskrit, something akin to suture, you know? Sutras are texts that are refined down to their most elemental form, to like a seed form, almost. So there might be two or three words, sometimes one word, to represent a whole subject. And the idea is that, you know, a particular master has boiled it down into three words, and then like ramen noodles, you can pour boiling water on that thing and it will expand out, and you'll have all that you need there. And so the Yoga Sutra is like this. Very, very short phrases that are meant to contain a lot of wisdom. But they're easy to memorize, and if you can hold these short phrases, then you can always check in with these larger processes, if you've been instructed in what the short phrases mean. Well, in Sufism, we have a series of eight short phrases like this around meditation that come to us from a group of early Sufis that were called the Khwajagan in Central Asia. The Khwajagan, it means something like, you know, wise masters and masters of wisdom. And one among them, a master called Abdul Khalik Gujdawani, formulated these eight short phrases that are generally called the eight principles of the Khwajagan. But I tend to think of them as the eight aspects of Sufi mindfulness.
Sufi
mindfulness.
Mindfulness.
Yeah. Four of them, the first four are in Arabic, and the second four are in Farsi. The first one is Hosh Derdam, mind on the breath, or awareness on the breath, consciousness on the breath. Just paying attention to your breath. Giving awareness to it. The second one is Nazar Bar Kadam. Watch your step. Now, because these are in seed form, they could be many different things. The first could be just simple breathing practice. The second could be referring to a walking meditation practice. In the context in which I'm seeing it right now, mind on the breath, then Nazar Bar Kadam, watch your step. Start to see your breaths as a progression. Steps leading somewhere. You follow them. One, two, three. Three, Safar Dar Vatan, journey homeward. Start to follow these steps, this series of breaths, home. Start to take the inner journey. You're drawing away from the external world and you're journeying inward on the breath. Where do you arrive? Number four, Hilvat Der Anjuman.
What was the number four?
The fourth one?
Say it again.
Hilvat Der Anjuman. Solitude in the crowd.
Okay.
So as we're journeying homeward with the third, eventually arriving at a place where we have a state where we've withdrawn our senses somewhat from the external world inward, and we have an experience of solitude while still among people and things. And there's still some awareness of what's out here, but we're holding a center. Then, switching to the Farsi, Yad Kard, which means remembering. And in this case, remembering a particular object of meditation, whatever that might be. It could be a wazifa, or a particular name. Could be the breath itself. But remembering an object of meditation. Then, quite rightfully, we get bazgasht, which means returning, because your mind drifted. You went away. You were meditating, and then you weren't. And it took you a while to realize it. Return. Come back. Then, nigadasht, watchfulness, attentiveness. Now hold on a little tighter. Not too tight, but you drifted away. So you need to hold more focus now. You thought it was good enough to just remember. And then you weren't. Oh, pull it back. Hold it a little tighter. Keep a focus. And then finally, yaddasht, which is remembrance. And those of you who were here when I was talking about dhikr, that there was a difference between remembering and remembrance. And what was the difference? You remember? Somebody remember?
One is something that's active. It becomes in the state that you're actually in. You don't have to keep efforting toward it.
Right. You don't have to keep efforting. Remembering is an effort, an engagement, an activity. To be in remembrance, you're being done, as it were. You're not doing so much. And so it lays out these aphoristic statements are in seed form, the basic process of meditation that you need to remember all the time. So it shows that there was a strongly developed meditative tradition very early on in Sufism. Now, in these aphorisms, the Khwajagan are clearly, at least Abdul Khalik Bushtuwani, is saying, or seems to be saying, that the breath is the thing that we follow to find our way homeward. But where is home? Told in the tradition that home is in the heart. So a traditional description of muraqabah, the word for meditation basically in Arabic, means to watch over something, to watch over, to pay attention to something. And one of the traditional descriptions is muraqabah is the presence of the heart with God and the absence of the heart from all that is other than God. Muraqabah is the presence of the heart with God and the absence of the heart from all that is other than God.
That begs the question of what's other than God, though.
Yeah.
But it gives us two things to focus on instead of just one. We follow the breath home, and the home is the heart, and we want to keep these two things in mind. both the breath and the heart. Then Piramurshad Hazra Nai Khan writes, peace comes when self is in harmony with the rhythm of the heart. This is accomplished in silent meditation by entering into the life stream of the heart. If there is any form of concentration to be used in meditation, it consists in first getting into the rhythm of the heart by watching the heart beats, feeling them and harmonizing with them. Then one centers all feeling in the physical heart, and out of feeling one selects love, and out of love, divine love. It's a remarkable statement, saying that the proper focus of meditation for us is on the heartbeat. And based on this and other statements in Murshid's teachings and things that he learned from Pir Vilayat around this, my meditation instructor, Puran Bear, developed a very specific technique of meditation around the heartbeat, coordinating the heartbeat and the breath. And he called it heart rhythm meditation. It could also be called, you know, muraqabah, you know, al-qalb, you know, meditation of the heart. And it's that particular practice that I want to talk about, mainly because it's been my practice for the last 18 years, 16 years. But prior to doing that practice or talking about that practice, you first, you know, if you want to establish yourself in good meditation, you first have to create a proper foundation for meditation. And that has to do with posture. And there are really what I consider eight aspects of posture. It's actually a process of going through before you start your meditation. And it gets to be a very simple process over time to find your proper seat and proper structure for the body. And this is actually really important. So let me go through the eight steps. The first step is to establish a base. Now, there are all kinds of texts that tell you the exact sort of pose you need to be doing, you know, whether get yourself into full lotus, you know, and this is the best posture for meditation. And, you know, if you want to have this realization, then, it's siddhasana, whatever it might be. And these will achieve these perfect effects. I think the particular pose is not so important. What they're really trying to do is create a certain kind of structure that allows you to sit straight up comfortably. The word asana doesn't mean pose, it means easy, comfortable. It means a pose you can be in comfortably for a long time. So it should not be difficult. It should be maintainable. And that's the point. And in terms of establishing a proper base, now, and this will be different for all of us because we have different structure. Not everybody can do the same poses in the same way. So poses really should be flexible. Now, I can sit in seiza, this Japanese style, very comfortably, very easily for a long time. Not a problem at all, but I'm very bendy. But it's a great pose for me. What is most important with a base, whether you're in a chair or in seated meditation, is actually to have yourself propped up slightly so that your legs are angled down slightly. Your butt is a little higher than your knees. You know, and you could do that by sitting on a cushion. Whatever achieves this angle is extremely important, because it's not actually important to sit flat. You want the angle, because your spine has a natural curve at the bottom of it. And if you accommodate it, you'll sit straight naturally. And that's what we want in an asana. It makes a comfortable, natural pose. If you're on a chair, what you do is you come to the edge of the chair so that your knees drop below your buttocks. So they angle down. So if you're ever going to do meditation in a chair somewhere, just come to the edge and let your knees drop down. Your spine will straighten naturally. You don't have to do it now. If you want to be more comfortable, you can step back. But sit back. So that's the first aspect of posture, is to establish a proper base, whatever it's going to be, half lotus, full lotus, just being in a chair, legs angled down. But prop it up. Get propped up. You know, people aren't just sitting on cushions for comfort. It's actually necessary for better posture. Then is basically your arm position. Arm and hand position. And so the texts are always, oh, well, this is a good one. This is a good one. But all not so important. What's actually important is to create space right here so that you're not creating tightness around your rib cage. What you need to allow for is breathing space here. And so the Zen instruction about imagining an egg held right here very gently is pretty much correct, because it's really just about leaving some room here. Also, if your hands are just dropped to the side, your arms are just dropped to the side, there should be proper room. But things that close over make it harder for you to breathe, to get the expansion in your ribcage. So arm position, wherever is comfortable for you, as long as it leaves this, they're all good. As long as they do that. Third, fourth, and fifth instructions come from Puran. And he taught me to do this. That third, on an in-breath, lift your shoulders up to your ears. And then a deeper in-breath, take them back to the middle of your back. And then exhale and let them down. What he pointed out was by going through a process where you take them up high, taking them back, and then relaxing, you find a natural royal posture. And he described it that way. A sense of being regal in your body. And there's a wisdom in this, because if you say to somebody, sit up straight, but sit naturally, they're like, they don't know where that is. We don't know where that is. And he pointed out to me, he says, it's only after tension that we know what relaxation is. We don't know what relax, if you just say relax, we look for it. But if you tense and then relax, you find the body just, it finds its place, but we don't know how to look for it. So by taking this too high, too far back, and then letting it go, it drops right back, and it drops into the proper place after that. So it's only after tension that we know where relaxation is. So base, arm position, up, back, and then you settle here. And when you settle here, your head should be somewhat straight, chin slightly down. Good head position. I mean, you can't be here, you know, where this is going to end in meditation. You can't be here. It's just got to be a good, settled place. But that pretty much comes out of this also. So 3, 4, 5. 6 is, what are you going to do with your mouth? Hanging open doesn't work. Closed too tight doesn't work. So it's about keeping it soft. Many meditative texts talk about keeping your tongue in your, just behind your teeth. You're just up in the palate there. Some people can do it, some people can't. I have plugged nostrils, it's harder for me. It's supposed to keep down on the swallowing. It doesn't work for me. But it's really just about not too tight, not too loose. Not so loose that you're breathing through your mouth either. If you possible, you want to breathe through your nose. Seven, what are you doing with your eyes? It doesn't matter so much whether you're doing closed eye or open eye, with this exception. For years I was doing a closed eye meditation, and I was discovering that, you know, I would do this meditation in the morning, and then when I would come out of it, and I'd be in a very peaceful, absorbed state, and when I come out of it, I'm annoyed at everything. My wife is talking to me, you know, it's just like, and it finally dawned on me that I was going within in such a way that I was identifying everything that's inside and in this darkness is all good, and everything out is bad. And then it became necessary for me to start to do my meditation with eyes open, so that there was always a relationship between this internal world that I was experiencing and the external world, that there wasn't some artificial or firm boundary. Now, that was me. It's not necessarily everybody else's experience. I'm just saying that's one thing that can happen. Eyes open, eyes closed. It's just, what are you going to do with your eyes? If they are open, one of the instructions, say, from the Karmakagyu tradition of Buddhism would be to, like, put your fingers here at the end of your nose and then focus on the pinky. Hold that, or to imagine a spot maybe 4 feet in front of you. What I think is more important is not to look at anything, but to keep your eyes open with a soft gaze. That's eyes open, but withdrawing your attention from any focusing, any particular focusing. Now just actually focus ahead of you, and then withdraw into your mind into some thought of a person, maybe. That's a soft gaze. Somewhere out here. And then 8, beginning your breath practice. And as Pirvalai would say, always begin it on the out-breath. Start to follow one out. And these 8 steps, I find, are really extraordinary. Because once you learn them, you can do them very quickly. I sit down, establish my hand position, back, tongue in the palate, gaze, and I'm breathing. But 20 minutes into your meditation, or 10 minutes in, you may find that you're doing this. And
no head nod.
Yep. And then you just base, arms, and then you're back. You go through the steps again very quickly, and you're back into it. So much of meditation is about returning, vazgasht, returning. But that proper structure is important because your body is going to take attention away from the object of your meditation. And the more comfortable, easy posture it can maintain without moving, you'll be able to maintain the object of your meditation so much better. In fact, if you can keep your body still for long enough, your body's taking in information all the time. My legs can feel the weight of my hands on them. They kind of know the separation between my hands and the legs. They know the heat that's coming out of my hands. There's all this sensory experience that's happening. But after about 20 minutes, if you remain still after about 20 minutes, your pressure sense turns off. Mm-hmm. You know? And you get into a state, if you were to feel into your body then, that is somewhat monolithic. It's like one thing. Right now my hands are different things than my leg. Mm-hmm. But after 20 minutes, I'm more like a molded statue, you know, like of the Buddha. Mm-hmm. You can see the little hands on there, but they're all one thing, you know. They're all clay, or they're all this resin, you know, that's made that statue. After 20 minutes, you feel more like that. And that's great. This body doesn't have to move. There's nothing else going on. So, you know, the whole thing about being in meditation for a certain amount of time, you know, 20 minutes of meditation is recommended, or 30 minutes. A lot of it has to do with just getting the body completely settled. So much talking in this session on meditation. So I'm going to get to the meditating. I see meditation as a process of establishing something, not just a technique. And I think you do have to go through a process of establishing the right posture. And then very nicely becoming conscious of your breath. So on that eighth step was to watch an exhalation. So if you come forward on your chairs just a little bit to angle your knees down. Let's just try to be conscious of the breath now. Hosh der dam, mind on the breath, awareness on the breath. Just pay attention to it. Not trying to change it. Just watching it. Do this for a minute or two. If you need to, go through those eight steps. Base, arm position, leaving room for your lungs. Shoulders up, then back, and relaxing into a royal posture. Mouth not too tight, not too loose. Soft gaze or eyes closed. Breathe. Get into a relationship with your breath. Get to know it. Feel how it lifts your chest. Feel its delicacy as it just leaves your nostrils or enters them. Notice that it has four phases. A rising inhalation. A top after the inhalation where it's retained. descending exhalation, and a bottom before the next inhalation. Four phases. Inhalation, retention at the top, exhalation, tiny retention at the bottom. Just watch these four phases. Notice the natural length of each for you. Some people hold at the top, some people hold at the bottom of the breath. Your breath might be long and deep or short, staccato. Start to bring some movement into your fingers. Relax your posture a little bit and open your eyes. Did anybody notice anything distinct about the phases of the breath, where it was held, or whether the bottom or the top, or how long?
No one stopped at the bottom for a long time.
Yeah, you held at the bottom?
Yeah.
Anybody else, anything?
Exhale was longer for me.
The exhale was longer. Anything else?
I find breathing in hard to judge. Like I go, or no.
This is all great, because all of this is information. Not to be judged, but it's information. Holding at the bottom, your lungs are empty when you're holding at the bottom. You know? Holding at the top when you're full, it's interesting. If you have different lengths of exhalation and inhalation, this may be information about how we're living, or how we think about or feel about certain things. Again, not to be judged, but to get into relationship and to get to know. And it may be affecting our emotional states or reflecting our emotional states or both. Both reflecting emotional states and influencing the continuance of them in one way or another. So if we could shift the pattern or balance out the pattern, we might also balance out some of the emotional states because they go both ways. Now, that's the first phase, just coming into relationship with conscious breath. The next thing we want to do is create rhythmic breath, get into a rhythm. And so now we'll be conscious of the breath, but we want to get into a kind of pendular rhythm or swing the breath a little bit. And you have to imagine that here, maybe imagine the heart is in the center of your chest. And your exhalation starts centered in the heart. And it goes out somewhere a few feet in front of you, parallel place right out here. And as you inhale, it swings back and hits its high point in the heart. We call it swinging the breath. So it's always landing momentarily in the heart. And the exhalation is landing somewhere in another heart, maybe just the heart of this space. You can do this as a paired meditation, where my exhalation lands in your heart, and it's the same as your inhalation. And then when you exhale, you can do it as a paired practice like this, swinging the breath between hearts. Or you can do it solo, just allowing it to center in the space. Sometimes you could put a question on the breath. Where's my beloved? And just let that question keep going up. Where is my? Whatever the question might be. And wait for an answer to come back. These are practices you can do with swinging the breath. But let's just get into that. Be conscious of the breath first. Use your imagination to swing it from your heart out a few feet in front of you. You can swing it across the universe if you want, but it's sometimes easier to imagine just a few feet in front of you swinging. Inhale, and it comes and it lands back in the center of your heart. That becomes comfortable. Start to keep a count. 1, 2, 3, 4. 4. It may not be that for you. Watch the length, but start to even the length of your exhalation and inhalation. Find what the natural count is for you, and then even it out so it's the same going both ways. Again, start to bring a little movement into your fingertips. Relax your shoulders a little bit.